Welcome to the Eat, Train, Prosper podcast, where we provide you sustainable training principles for strength and building muscle, effective nutrition practices for improving and maintaining a lean physique, and practical lifestyle habits for becoming a champion of your own health, both inside and out. Hosted by Aaron Straker and Brian Borstein. Happy Tuesday, guys. Welcome back to another episode of Eat, Train, Prosper. Today, Brian and myself have two awesome guests, Zach and Josh from Data Driven Strength. And before we get into all the sweet topics we're going to talk about with them, I'm going to have them introduce themselves.
So first of all, Aaron and Brian, huge thank you for having us on. I will say this is our least favorite part of podcasts is giving the introduction here. But just briefly, Zach and I are both research assistants at the Muscle Physiology Lab here in Florida Atlantic University. Zach just started his PhD. I'm a master's student, so a lot of our time is spent in the lab there. Otherwise, we're powerlifting coaches. We kind of work with people all the way up from, you know, national, international level competitors. And we also have, you know, kind of like some general population, just general strength and fitness clients as well. So, we're typically working with powerlifters, but we just like lifting weights. Powerlifting kind of found us. We just like lifting weights. It turns out that a lot of people that like lifting weights do powerlifting. So that's kind of where we've landed. But yeah, that's a general overview of who we are and what we do.
So is y'all's background, like, you pretty much found powerlifting straight out of the gates when you first started lifting? Or, cause I mean, you guys speak about things with like a bit of a hypertrophy flair more than I hear people talk about in other facets of the industry. Like, people that are more focused on strength tend to just focus on strength, but you guys are constantly throwing the hypertrophy thing around. So how is your background with training?
I would say, I mean, definitely speaking for myself, and I think Josh is pretty similar. I'd say we both got into this primarily through sports, which, I mean, is a pretty standard kind of explanation of how people find lifting weights. But that was definitely the way that I kind of saw everything through initially was, you know, how do I get faster? How do I get stronger for sports? And so that kind of initially got me into looking to read stuff and everything. That's how originally I found Westside. And kind of that was kind of methods was where I kind of started and, you know, matriculated my way down the path that we all probably have. And then, you know, you find, you know, hypertrophy training, powerlifting, it all kind of comes together. And I think Josh and I, like you said, originally, we both just like lifting weights. So I think we both see ourselves like spending time very much on both sides of the aisle there. And I think because of that lens, I think it allows us to see both of the problems, if you put it in kind of quotes there, of strength and size, and it may be a little bit different light. And I think they complement one another, especially when we look to kind of work with our clients. So I think it kind of helps in both ways there. But my personal story is definitely from sports first and kind of find our way into the objective nature of powerlifting from there.
Exact cool. Same.
Yeah, I remember when I first started training too, like I always kind of biased toward lower rep ranges just because they don't hurt as much. and I never really was good with the lactic acid accumulation thing. So I kind of started, I mean, I also started in sports, much like Straker did too, but I always was a fan of the lower reps and the shorter work sets. And it's interesting. This wasn't even a question I had, but I wonder whether that's like something that, because maybe I have slightly more fast twitch dominant fibers, like maybe that was going to be something that I was going to veer towards no matter what. Whereas somebody else that maybe with their sport was, say, more aerobic, like they were a runner or a rower or something like that, maybe they would have found more interest or benefit from like higher rep ranges. So I know Aaron can probably relate to that with the football work that you were doing. And I was playing basketball and other kind of anaerobic type sports.
Yeah, we didn't do a lot of high reps. And what's funny is when you were kind of talking like same thing, we got into lifting through sport. I was at first introduced to lifting through powerlifting, but they didn't call it powerlifting. But I mean, we went and competed in powerlifting and did single ply competitions. And I thought every high school football player across America did that. And that's like very far from the truth. So it was very interesting then shifting out of that to just like being a bro and lifting weights and not having to put that squat suit on that, you know, busted the blood vessels in my legs and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I can honestly, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think there is a ton of like self-selection, like you were saying, Brian, like even within kind of this niche of people that lifts weights at least four times a week, and you're like, oh, I'm not a super high responder. It's like on a population level, you probably are at least a pretty good responder because you've seen enough to actually, you know, be encouraged to keep showing up. So I think, you know, that's like at a very basic level, self-selection, and then, you know, fiber level specific stuff, you know, leverage specific stuff. It probably goes on and on and on, kind of like you mentioned, Brian.
Very interesting. Yeah. Cool. Well, we'll all jump into all of this in a little more detail. Should we do last 7 days real quick, Strager? Cool. All right, Word. Well, I'll start this out. I guess my diet is mostly more or less over. I've been progressing carbs linearly from last week into this week. I had about 5 progressively higher carb days, ending with about 450 on the day before my photo shoot, so Sunday. And I think it worked pretty well. I think the photo shoot went well. We'll see when the photos all come out. I am just excited to not be dieting anymore after 4.5 months, which is a really great feeling. Aaron's talked a lot about how his favorite nutritional periodization period of time is the period coming out of the diet and reversing and increasing the calories and all that. So it's been wild seeing like I just kind of saw my physique and I was flat all the time. So I was just like looking at myself compared to myself and I was like, oh, I am looking better, blah, blah. And then you start adding the carbs in and you're like, wait, shoulder veins and like ab veins, like what is going on here? So it's cool to be able to see the effect of the food that's going into your body and how that impacts the way that you look, like on a very acute basis. So even the morning of the photo shoot, I woke up and felt really flat for some reason after 450 carbs the night before. I don't know how I did, but I was.
It just wasn't enough.
No, I mean, it either wasn't enough or I just like slept and got dehydrated and whatever. So I woke up and had, you know, 2,500 milligrams of sodium and potassium and another 220 carbs. And then like within an hour, everything kind of came to life. So, Aaron, I'm actually going to talk to you about this in the future more about whether this means that maybe I'm a candidate for more of like a more immediate, like acute loading, like a backload type thing versus like a progressive linear load. But I find that all really interesting. And I'm sure it's stuff we can delve into next week when we don't have guests. And then the last thing I'll say is that tomorrow, Wednesday, I head up to Fort Collins to go train with Alberto Nunez and Miner. And they're going to be generous enough to give me a little bit of a physique assessment and let me know where I'm at and how far I might have to go if I were to don the Speedo and present on stage. So we'll see what kind of feedback I get there. And yeah, we'll update it next week on the episode. So what's up with your last 7 days, Straker?
Not much. I posted this very briefly on my story. I'm waiting to start my gut protocol, but there's like one thing I need to do first. And unfortunately, there is a new FedEx saga in my life. I ordered some supplements from this company that I always order from, and then I'm always very shocked at how quickly they get here. It ships from Kentucky. It's been 12 days now since it shipped in Kentucky. It's been here in Salt Lake since Thursday, just like looping around doing God knows what at the FedEx facility. So it's like, I don't know what's going on with FedEx here, but it is a massive problem. Like this is the 6th order in like the last month and a half that they just cannot seem to deliver. And it's not like I live in some weird spot. Like we're in a townhouse in the middle of the city. So I have no idea what's going on. Hopefully it's here today. I tried to be like, hey, I will come pick it up at the warehouse. Like I just want the damn package, but they just have like no idea where it is. And like the people you talk to don't have a clue. So I'm just playing the waiting game and trying not to get super frustrated. But to give a little backstory, Zach and Josh, before I would be ordering some overnight chicken from this place in New Jersey called the Chicken Pound, because I've just been in the streak of feeling lazy and I just don't want to food prep my own chicken. And 3 times in a row, like the overnight delivery, FedEx took like 4 or 5 days to deliver and the chicken would show up like lukewarm and we just had to like keep trying and trying again. So I have been having like issues with FedEx. So that's really been my only update. Transitioning into training 4 days per week, which I've kind of settled into now, which generally I kind of don't like as much, but I'm just taking it each week and then just filling in hiking, going on adventures on Sundays. But that's it for me.
FedEx is trying to hold down your macronutrient gains, dude.
Yeah.
Dude, do you not have a crock pot? It's so easy to make chicken.
I live in Airbnbs. So
oh, okay.
Yeah, any travels, anything.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's right.
All that stuff. Yeah.
I was going to say,
what's going on with you guys?
Bag of frozen chicken, can of salsa, 8 hours, good to go.
I like it. Zach. You guys have anything good in your last 7 days you want to update us on?
My life is considerably less exciting. I'd say the big win for me past week is, so I actually collapsed my lung pretty recently. So I've been working back from that in terms of training, and this past week kind of feels like the first week I've been able to, you know, really feel like I've been training again. I'm still rehabbing my lower body a little bit, working through some stuff there. But as far as like my upper body, been training my bench and my chin-ups actually for strength, and been able to put like a solid block of training in and really feel like I'm back to, you know, having ideas when I train, get to experiment with some different stuff, like the thing that drives us to have fun when we're doing that. And that has significantly improved my kind of just day-to-day experience, being able to look forward to training and not feel like I'm just climbing back to where I was all the time. So yeah, grateful for that. Josh, what about you?
Go for it, Brian, if you were going to say something.
I was just going to ask if chin-ups means that you're using a supinated grip, or if that's just a
Okay. Supinated, yep.
Yeah, for me, I would say the biggest thing in the last 7 days is I feel like I've been more excited for training than I have been in a while. So I've personally, and I think Zach's kind of on a similar schedule, I've been getting in 3 training sessions a week for about 70 to 80 minutes, just like with our schedules with academics and trying to fit in other stuff, maintain some degree of interpersonal relationships, just been going first thing in the morning, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, trying to get something in, and just cause that's what's going to be the most sustainable with our current schedules. But things have been going well, and I kind of noticed, I was like, hey, I'm kind of within striking distance in terms of being at my best numbers of all time. Which is exciting given like I'm kind of sacrificing optimal, if you will, to crawl rather than to run right now, which I'm accepting, proactively. The other thing within the last 7 days is I've been kind of doing an audit of just tracking nutrition. So I typically don't track, but I do like to, you know, every 6 months, every year, track for a week, just kind of check in and make sure that kind of what I'm conceptualizing in my head still checks out. So that's been something I've been doing this week. And I think that gives some pretty good insights. You know, if you are kind of the person that would prefer not to track, kind of checking in, doing an audit every, you know, every 6 to 12 months can be a really good move. So, that's been helpful as well. But other than that, just trying to crawl and accepting that, training isn't optimal, but it's still having fun with it.
Yeah. I have, two comments on that actually. So, I also use kind of a satiety based, tracking route in the off season, if you want to call it, not like I have an in season, but, in the off season, I basically just track, ballpark protein grams, daily body weight, and subjective satiety, whether it's like overfed, underfed, or satisfied. Mm-hmm. And I just have like an Excel sheet and I just mark those 3 categories. And it's so freeing because the satiety index and the body weight basically tell you if you're overeating or not. Mm-hmm. And then the protein just makes sure you're covering all your bases. So I think that works really well for people that at least are familiar with tracking and understand macronutrient profiles. But again, to your point, it's like, I wouldn't take that approach if I didn't at least audit myself every, you know, 6 months or a year or whatever it was. Yeah. And then the second thing I was going to say is, you know, you mentioned the 3 times a week being suboptimal in a way, but every time in my life that I've done a strength phase, I've found the highest rate of success on 3 times a week.
Interesting.
And I wonder if that's got anything to do with proximity to failure. And this is going to be a big chunk of what we talk about today, but just cause it's on the top of my head right now. I wonder if like, if you have 70 to 80 minutes, are you spending a lot of that time working sub failure? Like a lot of the stuff that you guys have been researching and talking about recently, where maybe you have to do more sets, so you're not actually fitting as many like reps close to fatigue or whatever into your 70 to 80 minutes versus working closer to failure and getting more out of that time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense. So I would, the answer would be, it depends on kind of the primary goal of the training phase I'm in. And in general, when I shift goals, so when I shift from more of like a, hey, this is going to be a muscle growth biased phase versus more of a strength biased phase, I don't really see any changes in session time. I do more sets in the strength biased phase. Each set's a little bit further from failure. And as a result, I can take a little bit less rest period between sets. So what I typically do is I'll hook it up so that I hear the velocity in my headphone while I'm training. Let's say I have 80% for four triples. I'll kind of get an idea of on that first set, okay, the first rep of the first set, that's when I'm going to be the freshest. Let's say it's 0.35 meters per second. I'll say, okay, I don't want to see this go down, you know, a ton. So I'll just kind of auto-regulate my rest periods, make sure I'm not getting down to like 0.24, 0.25. Okay, that set was a little bit slower than I want. I'm going to take an extra 20 seconds for that next rest period. So I kind of auto-regulate it that way. Whereas in a hypertrophy focus phase, you know, typically less sets, slightly longer rest period, and I'm really focused on RIR accuracy. So I'm less worried about that immediate velocity feedback and just trying to make sure that I'm getting to the desired RIR.
And you're using velocity in the hypertrophy phases as well with the beeps in the microphone or in the headphones?
So I typically don't do it within the set. I typically just look at it after. So I'll kind of take a look at the last rep velocity, take a look at my RPE that I thought it was, and kind of see if it checks out. Some days most days I'm kind of spot on, like, okay, that velocity checks out with my RPE. Some days I'm like, okay, you know, my RPE accuracy is a little bit off for that day.
Good example of the kind of how much work you can get done using these kind of different approaches. For me, I just did on Monday, in like a period of like 20, 30 minutes, I did like seven triples on bench with like 80%. And then I did in the like an antagonistic superset, I was doing chin ups, like seven sets of five in the same time. It took me like 20, 30 minutes. So like on paper, that's a lot of sets, but in reality, that's probably a similar amount of work you could get done if you just kind of flip that to like four sets to pretty close to failure with like 3 minute rest period. So it's in our experience, it's pretty similar, so long as you understand that you have to stay on task, like when you're taking this approach. Like that's really the main thing when we kind of talk about this is like, well, people are like, oh man, you're gotta be training for 4 hours. It's like, no, but you do have to like understand that like taking only 30 to 90 second rest periods requires a little bit more, you know, mental focus to be able to make sure you're hitting your sets on the appropriate time to make sure you're not staying in the gym for way too long.
I had a quick follow-up question for you, Josh. You mentioned something around velocity being reported in your headphones. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so I use a device called a Vitruve. So what it is it's basically this little box that goes on the ground, and there's a string that attaches to the barbell. And it also has an app, so the encoder can hook up via Bluetooth to the app, and then I can hook up my phone to my headphones. If you have a rep one, it does the same thing. And I can set it so that after every single rep, it tells me how fast it was. So after every rep, once it registers a repetition, it'll tell me the velocity. And this little Siri sounding voice will go 0.32 or 0.30, whatever the case may be.
Cool. I have seen those actually. That's very cool. Yeah.
I actually have been really debating buying one. I feel like it's a good investment for the future.
You know, if you like to tinker, man, it's just another thing to kind of look at. Yeah. Yeah,
right up my alley, man.
The one thing I think is really interesting, I'm one of those people who my subjective perception of my rep speed is much different than if I video it. Because I'll be like, oh my God, that set was like, you know, brutal. And then I'll look at it and I'm like, was it? It doesn't look like it from this video. So that is really cool.
Yeah, I think if you have video and if you have a training partner to kind of keep you honest, I think that stuff will get you 99% of the way there. The velocity can be the cherry on top. I'd say 97% of the way there. If you train alone, velocity can be helpful or a little bit more helpful. But yeah, it's
same I would idea add, in terms having of regular experience, like feedback. Training very close or to failure is also going to, you know, further bias that percentage upward. If you have a really good sense of anchoring what like a true one RIR is, that's going to, you know, further allow you to register how far you are from failure. But if you're kind of just, you know, somebody that hasn't had a period in their training that's regularly done that, I think velocity is a little bit more advantageous in that case.
For sure. Yeah. If you have the experience, you can feel it slow down and you know that it's happening. Cool. Well, I have a, I guess, so I was listening to y'all's podcast, The First Topic, yesterday, and And Zach gave me a shout out. It was super cool. So basically what happened was they were talking about training at long muscle lengths and whether they ever use like partial range of motion. And this is something that Straker and I have been talking a lot about on the podcast recently. And we talked about with Helms when he was on. And so as Zach noted, I have been doing a lot of this on movements that are overloaded in the shortened position, like leg extensions and pull downs and a lot of the things you guys referenced on your podcast. And one of the things you said, Zach, was that it's a cool way to have fun and like mix it up or whatever, and that you've been using it with yourself and with clients. So I was curious just if you have anything to any feedback from both yourself and your clients beyond it's kind of cool and fun, you know, like what the experience has been like.
Well, I mean, from a theoretical basis, I think it has a really sound, you know, reason why you're doing it. I think, you know, we've had emerging evidence to the point now where I'm pretty darn convinced. We just had another study that came out in the biceps showing pretty meaningful hypertrophy that came from training at a longer muscle length in comparison to a shorter one. I mean, at this point, I think that's something we definitely need to take into account. Like one very tangible example I've kind of conceptualized for me is like for somebody's biceps training, you know, the standard kind of core movement you might train is like a barbell curl. I would probably shift that more towards like an incline curl now, as kind of the money maker there and something to really, you know, care about your performance and really track finally. I think that's a really tangible difference, but in general, I think it's just coming from sound principles, of, you know, maybe we can use these exercises that are generally a little bit less fatiguing, not taxing as many joints, but they come with a con, I guess, in some aspects of being challenging at a shorter muscle length. But if we can, you know, artificially use some of these strategies to also challenge it at a long muscle length, maybe we can get the benefits of, you know, not taxing your back in a hack squat, let's say, but also be able to challenge the quads at a long muscle length with the leg extension, then we can kind of get the best of both worlds. Now, the one thing to keep in mind is like, I don't want to be, you know, oh, okay, long muscle lengths are all that matters. There's absolutely no benefits to training in a shortened position at all. I don't think we have the evidence to say that. I think, you know, regional hypertrophy is the first thing that comes to mind, that I'm sure there is some degree of that occurs, you know, challenging at shorter muscle lengths, maybe a little bit farther down the quad, for example. But yeah, I think it's just it's a sound principle, you know, based approach that I think just makes a lot of sense. And especially for back movements was the first thing that I thought was like abundantly obvious, because there's not a great setup for, you know, a lengthened back movement and just kind of general equipment. And so, yeah, that, I just think it's a cool idea. And I was glad I saw you doing that, because I was like, oh man, yeah, this makes sense. And I tried it myself and have had a few clients do it as well. And like I said, pretty positive experiences thus far.
Very cool. Yeah. And then I'll just add real quick that I think that using more of those short range overload movements, maybe even without the partials, would potentially have more applicability in like a period of time where you're dieted or don't have sufficient recovery capacity, right? So I know like N1 does that. They'll bias their training a bit more toward like those short range overload movements with a little less on the lengthened overload when you're in a deficit. And then when you're in the surplus, you know, you have more recovery capacity. You can kind of ramp that up a little bit.
That's exactly what I was going to say to kind of follow up with what Zach said, is that, you know, kind of the thought process here, or one of the thought processes here, is that in general, people feel like they can do a good amount of sets with their back before they kind of feel like, okay, I'm kind of at that weekly training volume where, you know, I'm kind of in that sweet spot. But you know, a lot of those movements are hardest when the muscle's at a shortened position, and that seems to be a little bit less fatiguing, each of those sets. So if you do take this approach of, okay, I'm going to do my lat pull downs, and then once I can't bring it all the way down to my chest, I'm going to kind of do lengthened partials, right? And then kind of anchor my zero RIR at the point where I can't get to, you know, whatever halfway down or whatever you standardize it as. If you take that approach, you're not going to have the same set volume tolerance. So that's very important to keep in mind. So like for me, training 4 hours a week, that's a great approach because I'm able to, I think, get more bang for my buck. Again, we're going off some research that's kind of building right now. We'll see, maybe it changes, but it seems to make a good amount of sense right now.
Yeah, it definitely feels good. Straker, any thoughts?
No, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me, especially what, Josh was just saying about, you know, cause everyone kind of feels that way. Back can take so much more, volume, and it's largely because so much of your back movements are a shortened overload.
Biceps, side delts, similar story.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, that's an interesting idea to think of the incline dumbbell curl as like your primary like overloading bicep movement, because it is for sure the most damaging.
It's brutal.
You're going to get it's awful, and like when you fail it like you would fail like a back squat. Like you literally just can't get out of the bottom. You just get stuck there. And you're like, oh shit, I don't know how that happened. So that's interesting, and I love that movement. I wish there was more possible ways that you can do a bicep curl with the elbows behind you, because it's literally like the Bayesian curl, whatever you say, and then it's that, and I can't think of like too many other ways that you can do it.
This is what Zach and I talk about while we train, so we're on the same
page. We're like, man, we just should make a machine that, you know, does back movements in a length of position,
we just picked up a leg extension, and like an option is to, you know, do lengthened partials once you kind of can't get it all the way up. Yeah. But we're like trying to play with the machine and make it so that it is hard at the bottom right off the bat, kind of like adjust the levers of the, like, because it's a free weight machine. So we've been playing around with that stuff. So Brian, we're on the same page. If you think of any ideas, definitely let us know.
Go ahead.
Brian. No, go ahead.
On my leg extension machine, you can change the resistance curve because it's like a cam machine, you know? Mm-hmm. But the problem is, because I think it's like a home model or whatever, is that if I overload it in the bottom position, then I forcefully explode up and I get so much power going through it that it actually sends the leg extension piece all the way around into like a semicircle. And I'm like, oh, I can't even overload this at the bottom, you know? Yeah. So it's not perfect. Striker?
What I was going to say is I'm fortunate the gym here has like I don't know the make of the machine because it's like super old, but it's a preacher bicep curl, but there's the three locations to place your weight, so I can like overload the lengthened
like the prime machines.
Yeah, but I guarantee you this thing's at least 20, 30 years
old. I had one of those at my gym in my hometown when I trained at in high school. And I, of course, at the time, I had no idea how nice it was. I was like, man, this thing's nice. You can change the plates and stuff. This thing's cool. You know, you get your 30 sets to failure in one session, just like going back and forth through all the plates. Yeah, those machines are super cool.
Yep, and that's exactly what I'll do. I'll take like I'll push like two. When I do use it, I'll push like two hard sets in the length and overload, and then I'll do like one at the shortened, and I'm smoked. It's cool.
Love that. Cool. All right. Well, officially, I have a first question for you. We've kind of already almost kind of breezed over a lot of this, but if you guys have any additional things you want to say before we jump into further questions about kind of where you stand on the difference between training for strength or hypertrophy and how proximity to failure and volume might be considerations that you think about in those two arenas.
I'll kick it off, and then Zach, you can clean up anything I mess up. Right off the bat, I would say that we're of the opinion that good hypertrophy training is also good strength training, at least in the long term, right? So in other words, we spend a good amount of time just focusing on, hey, we got to make sure those RDL execution is spot on. We got to make sure that RDL RP accuracy is spot on as well. So that's the first thing I'd say right off the bat. And then the differences between the two, at least the way that we like to program, do largely come down to proximity to failure. Now you do have the loading component, right? Like in general, you're going to want to be touching heavy loads. You know, average intensity as well can go up when you're focusing on strength. But for strength athletes, we basically keep that in year round. So that's not a huge change when we kind of shift from a hypertrophy focus to a strength focus, because you're already hitting, you know, 85% plus on a regular basis just to kind of maintain that skill. But anyway, when we do transition to a more strength focused phase, let's say somebody is whatever, 6 to 8 weeks out from a meet, what we will do is we'll kind of make each set in isolation a little bit further from failure, but typically add more sets. So if you were doing, 80% for sets of five, for example, let's say that lands most people around, 5 to a 9 RPE. Maybe we do 80% for a bunch of triples or doubles instead in a strength focus phase. So what that allows us to do is kind of actually get the average velocity higher across those repetitions that are completed, which on the surface sounds counterintuitive, right? A one rep max is slow. We want to practice being slow. And that's true to some degree, but you also have to think about the force you're producing on those repetitions. So, you know, as you kind of fatigue within a set, your ability to produce maximal force is going to decrease. So what we're saying is, okay, let's kind of like take these little mini rests, if you will. Well, they are proper rest periods, but like enough that you need to kind of recover for that next repetition. Keep that force production high, still get in your training volume, but avoid those large decreases in force production that occur within a set. So in general, proximity to failure is what we really focus on in terms of like over a 12-week training cycle, right? Going from a hypertrophy phase to a strength phase that we shift. That's kind of the high level summary. Zach, I'll kick it over to you if you have any additional comments.
Yeah, just cleaning up a few things, but I mean, obviously that's the kind of the overarching principle. One, while the kind of the average RAR, average RPE may change, it's important to know that's always in the context of those heavy sets that Josh mentioned. So like one thing people sometimes get from what we're advocating for is like, you're just doing a bunch of fast reps and you have no practice for what a third temp would be in a powerlifting meet. That's not true. We definitely always advocate for the foundation of a strength program is those heavy exposures to high loads and high RPEs. And the reason the RPE is rising, it's not because you're getting tired throughout the set. It's simply because the load on the bar is so heavy. And so that's the kind of two different ways a set can be challenging is because it's load mediated or it's fatigue mediated. And when we are in a strength phase, we primarily want it to be the former rather than the latter. So that's kind of the overarching concept there, and understanding that there are benefits to training with high RPEs. But for strength, like I said, we want it to be that load mediated. So we get things like psychological comfort to very high exertions, the familiarity with shifting of loading demands under very heavy loads and maximal attempts. Third attempt squat is not the same exercise as doing sets of three with 70%. We're well aware of that. And so we want to make sure you have adequate practice to doing those third attempts with very high loads that, like I said, it's essentially a different exercise when you're putting yourself under those demands. The hips are going to kick back a little bit. You're going to have to lever the bar with your back some. And that's what we want to do so we can lift the most weight. And so just making sure that we're familiar with those conditions. Aside from that, I would say the other thing for, you know, training for purely hypertrophy, you'd want to make sure you accomplish is there are those biarticular muscles that we're going to want to make sure that we're hitting with slightly different exercise selection. For a powerlifter, we may not focus on that as much. You know, leg extensions are definitely a good tool, especially if we do some of the things we were talking about earlier in terms of manipulating the muscle length we're training. But in general, the rectus femoris isn't as big of a concern for a powerlifter, whereas a person optimizing their physique want to make sure they're hitting their calf raises, probably both seated and standing. Want to make sure we're getting in the leg extensions, making sure that we're, you know, adequately training the side delts, things like that. So you could see a little bit of a difference there in terms of the accessory work. While, you know, a lot of the people that we coach still want to, you know, have some physique development, and so we'll include a good amount of that kind of work as well. I would say for a powerlifter, you know, if all they cared about is powerlifting performance, one way we like to kind of phrase the accessory work is just training for load tolerance. So making sure your elbows, your shoulders, your knees are all able to tolerate the amount of training necessary to really push the three powerlifts. Whereas somebody for physique development, you know, we're going to want to make sure, like you said, Brian, we're going to stretch it from the lengthen and the shortened position, hit it from all angles, hit the biarticular muscles, and make sure those are all adequately challenged to really push the physique rather than just supporting really, you know, adequate powerlifting training. So I think that's the two things that come to mind for me primarily. Josh, I don't know if you thought anything else, but that's kind of where I'm at.
Straker, thoughts? All right, cool. So you guys kind of jumped on to both my question number two and question number three in that answer, but we're gonna roll with it and see if you have anything else to add that wasn't covered in that initial statement. So we know that the development of strength is a skill, that there's neural pathways, learning pathways that play a large role, right? So what type of neural complications might occur if the strength athlete is constantly grinding through tough reps? Because like you mentioned, the importance of them feeling these tough reps and how a back squat and a third attempt is a different movement than a back squat and a first attempt. But are there like complications if people are constantly training this way, as far as like compensations that might be occurring along the way, et cetera, et cetera? Like, what do you think about as far as that pertaining to those issues?
So I have a standard answer, and then I kind of have like a personal experience and something that I've also kind of picked up along the way answer. I'll start with the latter, circle back to the former. So for me personally, and I've noticed this with some athletes, particularly taller athletes, again, totally anecdotal here, but when like when you're fatigued, I notice that it's a lot harder to get into like the positions you want to for squat, bench, and deadlift. For me personally, when I'm fatigued, much harder for me to get to squat depth, much harder for me to get to in good position for a deadlift. So I think that is a potential complication, is just positioning sacrifices. But the more standard answer would be like, hey, we're just trying to balance the amount of fatigue that a given protocol generates and the stimulus, right? In general, we want those heavy exposures to top sets, maybe a single at 8, single at RP9, that type of thing. But that's going to come with, you know, some fatigue. That's going to come with more fatigue than a single to 7, but we want to practice a single to 9, a single to 10 to some degree, right? So it's just finding that balance. And I think another really important thing to keep in mind is that that's going to be different between individuals, your ability to tolerate a given training protocol. So in my view, it's a total balancing act between how much fatigue is this generating for the individual, how important is it for them to get this particular exposure, and then we can kind of work backwards from there.
I think the way that I interpreted that question, Brian, tell me if I'm off base, is like, why, based on all the things we just said, why would we not just do 30 singles at 10 throughout the week if we were training for strength? Like, why, what is the complication there that precludes us from doing that? And I guess the things that come to mind for me is, you know, obviously the things that Josh hit on. The second thing was, you know, the amount of practice that seems to like contribute to these positive strength adaptations doesn't seem to be a ton. So we just had the recent, you know, PhD project from PAC who looked at like the minimum effective training dose for pushing strength and powerlifters. And man, it seems like just doing one max a week can get you pretty good results in pretty trained people. And so I think that's the first thing, is like, when we are looking for that bang for buck cost benefit analysis for these like really heavy sets, it seems like a really small dose is going to allow us to get a majority of the benefit from those sets. And so then the question becomes, okay, we start doing 2, 3, 4, 5 exposures to those per week. Are we really getting that much more juice from that lever of strength adaptation? And in our experience, and again, this is just speaking anecdotally, I think once you have those kind of in the program, I think hammering that nail doesn't necessarily seem to get you, you know, a considerably greater result. Once you are familiar with that heavy exposure, you get a decent amount of practice, hammering that same nail doesn't seem to result in exponentially greater strength adaptations, and there's pretty meaningful diminishing returns. So then the next question becomes, okay, what other avenues of this strength equation can we attack? And in our experience, that's where, you know, hypertrophy is definitely going to be a big contributor to that long term. And then it just comes to, how can we accumulate the training volume necessary to acquire sufficient skill practice in a non-fatiguing way and drive hypertrophy long term that doesn't affect those big heavy top sets that we are thinking to primarily drive the strength adaptation in the short to moderate term. And that's where we kind of come to this proximity to failure equation. We can still train with relatively high volumes. We might drop it a little bit depending on the loads we're using and all that good stuff. But for the most part, we can keep our volumes relatively high, which should be good for hypertrophy long term, allow us to maintain a lot of the skill practice we've accumulated and built our strength with. And then it doesn't affect the performance of those top sets, so we can really push those and make sure our peak intensity is really up to par with what we're ultimately trying to maximize. The only other thing I'll speculate, and again, this is not super evidence-based, just something I've noticed anecdotally, is training in a super high fatigue state might harm things like rate of force development, which for, you know, hitting a maximal attempt for 1RM, our ability to overcome a heavy load prior to fatiguing, that might be important on test day. So getting in a really, really fatigued state might harm things like that. That probably isn't ideal. So that's another reason why we might want to try to kind of disperse the fatigue in some other ways.
Aaron, anything to add?
No, I mean, all that stuff just clarified some things for me that I had, you know, kind of anecdotally realized about myself in strength cycles and stuff. So it was pretty cool just to get like a closure on that, I guess.
Yeah, I can definitely say that, especially on deadlift, to your point, Josh, that like, if I have even one rep where positioning isn't perfect and like maybe I go into like a little bit of flexion as I'm coming up or something, I could drop 100 pounds off the bar and I still can't get into like perfect position after that. It's like, it caused so much fatigue through that spinal column that it's just unable to be set until I like recover that again a few days later or whatever it is.
Yeah. That can definitely be trainable as well. Like just exposing yourself to that position. Okay. But I totally agree. Like some people are just going to be, more sensitive to a given position than others. And I think that has downstream programming effects.
So how often in like over the year of a macro cycle or whatever, how often are you guys taking an RPE 9.5 or higher single rep? Is it just in like testing and competition, or is there actually time like throughout a training year where you'll throw those in?
Go for it, Zach.
Yeah, I think this, you know, hugely individual dependent question, and I would say lift dependent too. You know, I pretty frequently have people hitting near max bench singles pretty frequently, sometimes multiple times per week, just because that seems to be tolerated. And bench is really, really sensitive to jumping from an 8.5 to a 9.5 to a 10. It just isn't the same ball game. You get a little bit of that, you know, arch collapse, so the range of motion is slightly higher. You know, things like that just change the angles just enough where, you know, it's very easy to say that, you know, the power lifts aren't complicated. You know, there's not, you know, the technical, you know, prowess necessary is not the same as the Olympic lifts. But, you know, Mike Tirschier is, you know, he's said a lot of times there's little mini skills that go into those lifts, especially at maximal weights, that take, you know, regular exposures to really figure out and refine over time. And I think the bench press is especially the case there. For the other two lifts, I would say it's a little bit more sparingly, mostly because you're dealing with two lower body exposures to those intensities on two different lifts. So I think that's something to balance. But in general, I think the thing that makes it probably a little bit different in my case is that the way that your technique changes under those very maximal loads, it just seems to result in fatigue that's not the same in the bench press. When I, you know, drop range of motion in my bench press, it doesn't seem to cause like lasting lower back soreness like you talked about. Whereas if I'm taking a deadlift in a position that I haven't trained, like Josh said, like a little bit more lower back flexion, just anecdotally, that seems to result in significantly greater fatigue and losses of performance than a bench press would. So I think that's just something to note. But yeah, over 9.5, I would say for me is going to be reserved for testing in most cases, which would be like generally 3 meets a year for somebody. For the lower body lifts, but maybe a little more frequently on bench press. But I do think that's individual dependent, where I've had some people that just need to know what it feels like to hit those heavy weights a little bit more frequently, and that might come into the rotation a little bit more.
I totally agree. And Zach, I think you maxed out your bench 5 days a week for multiple weeks for a while. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I did kind of a Bulgarian-esque thing on my bench where I'd like max out 5 days a week. It was totally fine. I got really, really good at hitting the same weight really slow, but my actual max didn't increase a ton. It went up a little bit, but you know, I did that for about it was a little over a month. So yeah, I was maxing out five times
totally
a week.
Individual. I would crumble.
Yeah, but a bench press is definitely like a significantly less fatiguing movement than one of the axial loaded ones. So it is like, it does make sense. It's like, are you going to do it on a bent over row or a lateral raise? Like, exactly. Yeah, you could probably, whatever. Anyways, a bad analogy. Do you have anything to add to that, Josh?
No, I would just really, really echo how individual dependent it is. I have an athlete who is like top three in his country for bench press, and he does multiple bench only meets per year. So he's very good at bench pressing. He's very high just training tolerance for bench press. We can hit 5 singles a week, sometimes up as high as 9.5. I wouldn't make all 5 of those RP 9.5, but some exposures that high, whereas other guys just can't handle that. Again, it's going to be trainable to some degree, in the sense that, hey, exposing yourself to it more and more will help. But just in general, it is very, very individual in my experience.
Cool. Aaron, anything to add?
Nope, nothing for me on that one.
So this question is going to require you to conjecture a little bit. But in the putting options back on the table piece, which was really good, these guys wrote it and they did a podcast about it. Basically, the idea of the piece was kind of pushing for being able to do sets further from failure, and that you can still grow and or gain strength with, you know, 7 RIR or whatever. So my question here, and I don't know that there is an actual answer to this, but I like to make sense of it using the effective reps model, where, you know, you have one person that's doing 6 sets to failure. So with 5 effective reps per set, you're essentially getting like 30 effective reps with 6 sets to failure. And then by the same token, you could have somebody that maybe does 15 sets, but they do them to 3 reps from failure. So you're getting, you know, 2 effective reps each set. So now you're still also at 30 effective reps. So in my head, that feels clean and it makes sense and it's beautiful and I can put it in boxes and whatever, whatever. What you guys are saying. So now we have this idea of like, you know what? Maybe like you could just do 7 sets of 3 with like a 10 RM. So now we're talking like 7 RIR, 6 RIR, something along those lines, which means you don't have a single effective rep theoretically in there. So how can we make sense of this idea so that I can put it in a pretty little box and put it on my shelf and be like, okay, here's how many sets of 3 I need at 10 RM to make up for X amount of sets to failure or whatever, you know? Like, how can we just kind of put some context around that?
So, well, I think we can definitely provide some heuristics that we kind of go by. What I would say is that, well, first I'll kind of touch on the effective reps thing. I think it like the effective reps concept has to be true to some degree, right? I think basically everybody would agree at this point. It's not black and white. Once you get to the, you know, 5 RP all the way up to 10, then you can start counting, but it has to be true at some point, right? But I would just say 2 things. It's probably further from failure than we think. And it's also probably like a sliding scale on a repetition to repetition basis, right? It's very unlikely to be, an on or an off switch. Another thing to keep in mind is it's probably going to be like how far from failure you kind of reach a rough effort threshold where the reps really start to count. It's probably going to be dependent on the nature of the exercise, right? Is it a compound movement? Is it an isolation movement? What muscle length is it hardest at? Are you using maximal concentric intent, or are you just kind of like coasting through the set? All these factors are going to influence it. Now, putting the nuance aside, from more of a general heuristic point of view, the way that I like to think about it is once the load is like a 10 to a 12 rep max or heavier, I think you're kind of in that effective range more or less for hypertrophy, right? If you have a 10 rep max load on the bar and you do a set of 10 to failure, do I think that first rep is going to be as effective as the 8th, 9th, 10th? Probably not, but I don't think it's night and day. Right. And there are also benefits of those reps earlier in the set, especially for strength, right? And also probably from a fatigue perspective, right? So from a hypertrophy only perspective, I think doing, you know, sets of 5 with your 10 rep max load and doing a little bit more sets, accumulating a little bit more volume, I think that can be a totally fine way to go. And just based on, you know, kind of a strict effective reps model, you might be getting 0 effective reps per set, but I think that can still be a meaningful hypertrophy stimulus. So that's kind of my general heuristic, is if the load is heavy enough, right off the bat, you're probably getting a pretty good training stimulus. Now, to be clear, this is my opinion and is some conjecture. We could be proved wrong by research in the coming years, but that's kind of where I'm sitting right now.
Trying to decide how speculative I want to get here.
Very speculative, super speculative.
So, go for it, man. I think,
just be clear, it's your opinion.
Yeah, no, it's very much my opinion. So huge, here's a grain of salt. Make sure you look at it, really conceptualize that. So the one assumption that the effective reps model makes that I think is at least like it's based on sound reasoning as far as I can tell, and maybe just the way that we get there is slightly different, is essentially the reason the reps are effective, right, is we get full motor unit recruitment, and those motor units innervate the fibers that seem to elicit the most amount of adaptation in terms of muscle size and also the biggest and produce the most force. The way that this could work, in my opinion, is that, like Josh said, it's probably not 1-to-1 in terms of the comparison, these reps 8 RAR. And I think that can probably be slightly evidenced by a new study we have that doesn't seem quite the same regional hypertrophy with a group training like cluster singles at 85% versus a group training like 4 sets to failure with 85%. Overall, the growth, I think you could argue it either way, but in my opinion, I think that probably leans slightly towards the group training close to failure in terms of regional hypertrophy. That's only one study, to be clear, but I think it kind of indicates that. But the idea being, maybe if we stay far from failure under the conditions Josh mentioned, with heavy loads, particularly with maximal concentric intent, it may be that we are achieving maximum motor unit recruitment, and these fast twitch fibers are the ones that are receiving mechanical tension primarily. And if that's the case, kind of the biggest bang for our buck is kind of being checked, and maybe we're not getting the same overall stimulus, because as we kind of take a set to complete fatigue, fast twitch fibers will stop producing force because they're the most fatigable, and we kind of run the backwards Henneman size principle and fatigue those slow twitch fibers as well. So that makes sense in my head, in the sense that, you know, as long as we're training with heavy loads, using maximal intent, which is essentially maximal effort on every single repetition, we may just target the stimulus slightly differently. And I think this is evidenced by one study that I haven't really seen anybody talk about, but it just always never makes sense in my head. There was a study by Lynn, I think is the first author. One group trained with 80% to failure. One group trained with 30% to failure. And then they did a 30% of 1RM group that workload matched to the 80% of 1RM. So essentially what that does is that makes the group training with 30% of 1RM do like 12 reps per set, which is super far from failure. And what they saw was significant type 2 fiber hypertrophy, but not significant type 1 fiber hypertrophy. And based purely on the Henneman size principle, meaning that you need to take a set to failure in order to recruit the highest threshold motor units that innervate the fastest twitch fibers, that doesn't make any sense. So that is my super speculative personal opinion, huge grain of salt. Once again, look at it right there. There it is. Make sure you see it. That's how it would make sense.
Are they using maximal concentric intent on those 12 reps on the 30
rep
max?
Can't remember. Can't remember on that side. But we just had a new study by Anderson and colleagues that did do that, which was a within subjects design using velocity loss that did see similar hypertrophy between like 5 to 10 RAR to a group training pretty close to failure. So that, and that was with maximal concentric intent on single leg press and knee extension. So, but yeah, I mean, just from like a super speculative standpoint, that's how I could see it could make sense. Again, with the conditions being met that you're training with heavy loads and maximal concentric intent. But yeah, that's kind of my thoughts.
Motor unit physiology is very complicated. but the just one thing I think I'd want the listener to chew on, and again, we're not motor unit physiology experts by any means. But just think about it conceptually. If you have higher threshold fibers are more fatigable, and let's say we are confident they're in the game, is there a reason that those would really rev up near the end of a set? So no, that's kind of what Zach is saying, is once they're in the game, why would the more fatigue? Now Zach's going to add
two caveats. One, recruitment isn't the only thing that matters. So you can recruit a motor unit, but that same motor unit can be fired at a different rate. So that's another variable to kind of enter the equation for motor units and the fibers it innervates to produce maximal force. It can fire the action potential faster, just muddies the waters a little bit, but that's just something else to consider. And then two, I want to just make clear like how we get here. Like Josh and I, you know, very much believe in being outcome oriented and then working backwards rather than taking these mechanisms and speculating, you know, practical applications from there. We see in the longitudinal research, these certain things seem to be the case from the actual muscle growth that we observe. Then we work backwards and speculate why that may be the case, but we're always willing to change this part. Once the outcomes are updated, we get more information. You know, we get a few more of these studies that really measure regional and synergistic hypertrophy. I'm willing to change my mind. We're just kind of speculating how we get to the current longitudinal research that we do have, which seems to suggest that so long as the load is heavy enough, you're using maximal intent on every repetition, you seem to get relatively similar muscle growth. And that would be, in my opinion, why. It's not necessarily that it's the same. It's just you're checking that biggest bang for your buck, 80-20 threshold, the fastest switch fibers are getting a stimulus in which seems to result in similar growth.
Straker, anything?
I think to try and take everything you guys just said and then like move it into like more of like a practical thing, especially for the listener and myself, to be completely honest, wrap my head around it. So with training at, you know, further away from failure, lower RIRs or RPEs, the kind of thing that comes to my mind is you don't have that like subjective perception of like, I'm working really hard, right? If we're talking about a 10 rep max and I'm only doing 4 reps, right? Those 4 reps are you know, they're not super easy, but there's no metabolite buildup. I'm not breathing heavy, anything like that. All those things are more towards your lower, you know, RIRs, higher RPEs. But I think one thing that you guys, you know, brought up multiple times and when you were just speaking was for each of those first four reps or those four reps of that set, maximal concentric intent. So training, like pushing that first rep as if it was that 10th and trying as hard as you possibly can, trying to move that weight pretty much as fast as you possibly can with maximal force production. And that was kind of, I just want to, you know, clarify and ask you guys if that is what you mean by that, like trying with those four reps, like as hard as possible.
Yeah. So something we like to cue is like every rep is RP 10, not in the RAR sense, but just in the general effort sense, every rep should be RP 10. Now, this is going to be best for exercises where it's hardest at the bottom, right? Leg extension, you don't want to explode through and then like just, you know, fly through at the top, right? So there are, of course, some practical caveats, but that's a great point. And I think that was a really good overview. But from a practical perspective, a lot of people do enjoy training with lower RIRs, right? So I think that's something to keep in mind as well. And for situations like that, I just like to think of it as like a give and a take. If you're doing your tricep extensions to an RP5, it's kind of boring, right? Like nobody really wants to do that. I basically never recommend people do that. But if you are, doing something that's just a little bit more fatiguing, something that is, you know, might have some downstream effects in terms of your ability to complete volume within that session or later in the week. Or if you're a strength athlete, next time you get around to train that lift and you want to hit a heavy single and you want to have as low a fatigue as possible to hit a good number for that top set, then we can start to explore these strategies. So it's really all a give and a take, right? If training a tricep extension to an RP9 isn't going to mess you up, do it. It's probably more efficient anyways. You also have the benefit of better accuracy in terms of rating your RPEs or your RARs. So from a practical perspective, we're definitely not saying like take your 10 rep max on tricep extensions and do 4 reps. More so big compounds, stuff that might be a little more fatiguing.
Two things I was going to say real quick is, number one, I think super important part of this conversation is we're talking a legit 10 rep max. So a lot of people hear what we're saying like, all right, I'm going to go do sets of 10 at a 5 RPE. And in reality, they end up using a 30 RM. That is definitely not what we're saying. The RAR accuracy component of this is very, very, very important. And that's why in a strength context, it's usually less of an issue, right? Because we have these top sets that we can anchor our performance. We can do a percentage of that top set to make sure that we're in the adequate loading range. And it's really not that big of an issue. We're doing triples, 75, 80%. We're already in that range and RAR accuracy is less of a problem. For hypertrophy oriented training, this can be a little bit more of an issue. Rating a set of 6 at a 5 RPE is a pretty difficult task, and you can end up running into a 15, 20 RM there if you're not careful, which is why it's a little bit more nuanced for hypertrophy training as far as I'm concerned. And the other comment I want to kind of pair this with and comment is that I made a post about this recently. Like, the one thing we got to keep in mind also is that training to failure is almost never worse in the research. So if, in my opinion, for hypertrophy specifically, if you are going to, you know, be a little bit off in either direction, absolutely would rather it be in the high effort direction for hypertrophy specifically. There seems to be like this box that you kind of got to check for these higher RAR strategies to be sufficient. And if you're not totally confident that's the case, I would always probably go a little bit closer to failure for muscle growth in order to, you know, kind of check your boxes and make sure you give yourself a little bit of insurance in that way. So that's the other thing I always want to keep in mind is that, you know, got to make sure your RERs are accurate. And to do that, you might have to adequately go close to failure every now and again to make sure you are understanding what a true set at like 6 reps at a 5 RP really is. Like, that's a little bit more challenging set than I think a lot of people realize. But Jeff Nipper did a really cool kind of concept on his Instagram about this recently, seeing people take a set of leg press to failure. And there was still a bunch of people on there that were still like, in my opinion, like 3 or 4 reps in reserve. Like, and that is a perfect example. So like that set that they just did is what we're advocating for. What they're calling failure is 5 reps in reserve. So like some people's gauge of like, oh man, sets of 5 RP are super easy. Me and Josh are usually like, man, like I understand what you're saying conceptually, but like, dude, 2 RAR, like think about, you know, puking after a set of leg press. That's 2 reps removed from that. Like it's only a few more. Like that's still a pretty challenging set if all these other boxes are checked. So that's just something to keep in mind.
Yeah, for sure. No, I think that that's a really good point to for the listener to think about. I feel like, so you look at myself and I'm mostly a physique athlete and I do strength. I'm basically about to embark on my first strength phase in a number of years. Aaron and I talked about this last week. So I did do a bunch of strength. Zach, I've talked with you on DM about this. I did like the Ripito Texas method for 6 or 7 months. And it actually was really good. I mean, I was absolutely destroyed by the end of it from hitting 3s and 5s to failure constantly. But it worked. And I'm actually really excited to embark on a strength phase here. So one question I have is I want to utilize this approach of this kind of 5 to 7-ish RIR range. So if I know more or less what my like 10 RM low bar back squat or deadlift is, right, then I could basically take that 10 RM weight and that would be what I would start with for sets of 3. And in my mind, I'm thinking like, because these are big demanding movements, that I probably want to start with like 4 triples, maybe 5 triples at that weight. And then maybe in another week, I'll add to 6 sets. And then maybe I get up to 7 sets by week 3 or week 4 or something like that. Is that like a prudent approach? Is that how maybe I should do it? How do you progress those triples week to week? Like obviously you're using velocity, but not everyone has access to velocity. So do I finish that last set of 3 and I'm like, yep, still feels about as easy as the first set of 3? Or like what kind of things should I be using to determine when I should increase weight on the sequence?
I'll kick it off here. So in practice, what we will typically do is use a top set to anchor the load for the back off work. So work up to a top set of anywhere from like 1 to 4 reps, anywhere in that 5 to 9 RPE range. You can just use a generic RPE percentage chart type thing and say, okay, what's a ballpark of my estimated 1 RM for the day? And then you can have a percentage of your 1 rep max and calculate that. So a percentage of your estimated 1 rep max. So if you hit, you know, a given load for a single at RPE 8, for most people, about 92%, calculate 92% of that estimated 1 RM, find your estimated 1 RM based on that, and then say, okay, I'm going to do 75% for my triples today. Because, you know, 75% is about a 10 RM for most people, you're basically guaranteed to be good to go there. So from a practical perspective, I would say as your top set performances increase, then you can also kind of inch up the load used on your back off sets. And then what I'll do is I'll add an RPE cap for those back off sets. So let's say you do a single at an RPE 6 to 8, calculate your estimated 1 RM. Okay, I'm going to use whatever 75 to 80% for these back off triples with an RPE cap of 7. What that means is, hey, if any of these sets exceed an RPE 7, I'm going to drop the load by 5% or so for those, the rest of the sets. And that kind of has built in progression, if you will. What you kind of outlined included like an adding sets type structure. And that's a whole nother conversation, right?
Well, it's mostly because I haven't done a low bar back squat or a deadlift in so many years that I wanted to start at, you know, 3, 4 sets, something prudent where I'm not going to be sore for a week. And so I figured ultimately my goal is to get up to 7 sets or 8 sets or something like that. But I feel like it's just prudent to start slower.
Absolutely. I feel like you could even just add in like a top set with 1 back off set and just go from there. Like just that little bit of practice is going to go a long way. But yeah, I think I kind of covered everything there. And I agree. If you're rebuilding, then definitely, start nice and slow.
Yeah. I don't have too much to add. I think, like Josh said, especially when you're introducing a new movement, I would be extremely conservative with both the load selection and the volume you're dedicating towards that. I would imagine, Brian, one of the things you're also keeping in the back of your mind is like, I want to have adequate volume to at least maintain, hypertrophy progress, which is what I kind of inferred from what you were saying. So in that case, like Josh said, I would start with the way I always kind of think about it is like, okay, what would I start with? I'm just like doing like normal sets and then kind of flip the, what we call low fatigue protocol with that. So like, you know, three sets of five at a moderate load is pretty reasonable on day one. So, you know, like you said, four or five sets of three at a similar load is probably pretty reasonable. The one thing I will say, purely anecdotal, when you are able to produce more force kind of under the curve for a training session, I have found that to be a little bit more fatiguing for people that aren't used to that than normal. So the way I kind of think about it, it's like kind of another workload metric. If we were to track the peak force from your total, like let's just say you did 15 repetitions from three sets of five versus five sets of three, it'd probably be higher for the five sets of three. And while I don't think that's, you know, necessarily a bad thing, obviously that's kind of what we're going for. I have found like, you know, doing high velocity squats, people's adductors get super stiff the day after just from stuff like that. In addition to it being a new movement, such as something to keep in mind is like, I do think on paper, it's going to be like, oh dude, this is so easy. And then you do it and it's like, oh man, I'm a little more beat up than I thought. So always probably start more conservative than you think. But then I think the adding sets approach is probably pretty reasonable. And I think what I would do with that is just kind of go with my top set performance. If my top set's going up pretty well, and that's something you can rate with your RPE pretty accurately, as long as that's trending up and you're feeling great, probably you can keep the sets the same or maybe add one here and there. And then once performance kind of stalls out, then you can assess your recovery and go from there. But that's kind of how I would approach it. Just make sure you kind of respect the new exercise, new protocols, that kind of thing. I just know I've done that to myself so many times. Like, oh, okay, I usually do 7-8 triples with this and like hop in with like 6 on week one and then my adductors are just fried. So just keep that in mind.
No, totally. I love that. And I love the idea of using the top set as like kind of the gauge for the day and basing progression off of that. So I'm definitely going to, I made a note of that in the document as you were talking. So I'm going to make sure I incorporate that in. Straker, I have one more question on the bodybuilding strength stuff. Do you have anything to add real quick before I roll?
No, not from this one. Okay. Be fully transparent. Like when I do transition to my strength block, I will 100% be outsourcing that programming to someone else.
I was debating hitting these guys up, but I just love the process of figuring it out for myself so much.
I love it with the hypertrophy, but with the strength, in being completely honest, I don't think I can auto-regulate myself well enough. I think the ego will catch up a little bit and I'll, you know, be like, oh, I'm not as fatigued as my body's telling me I am. And I'm just going to outsource it so I can remove myself from the equation is basically what I'm saying.
That's interesting. We'll have to compare and contrast the two approaches and see how that goes. Cool. Do you guys have 15-ish, 20 more minutes? Yeah. Okay. I'll get you out of here in 20 minutes at most. Okay. So when a bodybuilder is setting up or embarking on a strength phase, I know I can kind of ascertain some of this from, I listened to the conversation, Zach, that you had with Iron Culture, about power building and stuff like that. So, kind of the idea that you laid out there was that hypertrophy work is hypertrophy work. Like don't try to do sets of five on pushdowns. And that obviously makes complete sense. But when you're programming a physique athlete, bodybuilder type person, and they're doing a strength phase, do you do this as like primarily like a strength phase and then you get back into hypertrophy? Or are you still utilizing these like hypertrophy, maybe even cable-based like isolation movements along with the core competency strength work? Because like one of the things Zach told me on DM was that you guys have this kind of subtle inclination that maybe there's a bit of a resensitization effect when you do just strength work and then, you know, you resensitize and you go back into hypertrophy. I know that was speculation, but like, is that a way that you generally would program a strength cycle for a physique athlete, or do you still incorporate those hypertrophy elements within the structure of that strength cycle?
Yeah. So if I was going to utilize these principles for somebody who's purely physique focused, this is kind of how I would think about it. Like you said, I think anecdotally, I've found that like intensity techniques or like advanced training techniques, like myo reps, drop sets, rest pause, stuff like that. I have no scientific evidence to back this up. It just feels like it works for about like 3-4 weeks. And what I think these strength principles are for hypertrophy training specifically is kind of the inverse of that. So if we do this high metabolite accumulation stuff for 3-4 weeks, our buffering capacity improves. So the system is like, this is no longer as stressful in a relative sense. I think the kind of strength oriented stuff is kind of in the opposite direction. It might maximize like some neural qualities and stuff for strength, but it probably decreases your ability to buffer metabolites, stuff like that, that may, again, very speculative, may have some sort of potentiatory effect for hypertrophy. So that is how I would kind of use it in terms of training for a physique only athlete. 70% of their training is going to be bread and butter, principle based, you know, training for hypertrophy, like we, you know, we all know. But I think these are kind of two strategies you can kind of intermix to resensitize and desensitize yourself to this metabolic stress aspect. So I would probably, just like a rough example, you know, you have your hypertrophy block, maybe two of those, throw in a strength block, where it's probably 3 weeks of these strategies where, you know, on hack squat, maybe this is where we're using that approach where we kind of flip the sets and the reps or something like that. So most of the sets are going to be farther from failure with a similar load. You still include all of the cable work, like you mentioned, your Bulgarian split squat, stuff like that. I don't think you'd take that out. I just think probably that's where we'd use a higher RAR paradigm of like, maybe instead of treating those to failure or one or two RAR, maybe we're going 3 to 4 on those. And just kind of conceptually everything builds on this aspect of minimizing the metabolic stress, maximizing force output for the exercise you're doing. And the result of that, and I can very much attest to this, when you do a powerlifting testing session and then you come back to week one of your hypertrophy block, metabolic stress is not very comfortable. And then you can kind of use that if there is a benefit to that. And, you know, I would say primarily we would argue that's probably psychological primarily at the moment, but just anecdotally, it seems like it could potentially be a physiological rationale as well. Then you come back to more, you know, metabolite oriented training that may kind of potentiate that a little bit more, do a couple weeks of that, then go back to your bread and butter and kind of repeat. That's how I see it for a physique only athlete. Obviously these strategies were birthed in strength kind of approaches. And I think that's where we primarily see it, but I do think there could be a potential application, particularly on compound exercises that, you know, are something that's pretty fatiguing. That's kind of where I see it. Josh, I don't know if you have anything to add.
No, I agree.
That's awesome. No, I love that. And especially the example you put out of the hack squat where it's maybe slightly lower reps and slightly further from failure. And that's kind of exactly the way that I kind of tentatively programmed my strength phases. I have like, you know, low bar back squat, deadlift one day. And then on 2 days later, I have like a pendulum squat. But my plan was to do like 5 sets of 5 with a 10 RM or something along those lines. So keep velocity high, et cetera, et cetera. Cool. So, Aaron, anything to add before I jump to the next section?
No, I just want to make sure, because I know we want to be respectful of their time, to save a little bit to talk about their DDSIP program.
Cool. Yeah, I'll be super quick on this one. I'll actually skip the final question that I have, and I just want to talk briefly about psychological arousal, because that's a term you guys use. And it, like, when I hear you guys talk about it, I'm like, it's literally defined like the last 10 years of my training and all the positives and negatives that I've gone through and the flows of my training. And it just puts things in and makes so much sense out of it. Right. So the way that I think about the way when you guys talk about this, because you have all the inputs, you have like the volume and the proximity to failure and the lengthened or shortened position and like all these things. But ultimately, like, I think the biggest factor as it pertains to me and probably many others is the idea of how many times you need to unrack the bar. You call them total unracks or whatever, I think was the term you guys used. And that to me, like, actually makes a difference. So like we talk about doing like 7 sets of 3. And so, yeah, you don't need to get like hyped up for 7 sets of 3. Like you can kind of just kind of stay sympathetic and just kind of, you know, walk up to the bar and do your thing, whatever, whatever. Or there's like 1 or 2 sets, but every set is like to the house and you have to like see God to finish a set. So I just loved the way when you guys initially talked about that, and I have a follow-up on this, but if you guys can just talk to the listeners a little bit about kind of some of the way that you guys think about this and how it might apply to training.
Yeah, I think right off, I honestly think you did a pretty good job overviewing it. Like for certain exercises, there's going to be different psychological considerations than other exercises, right? 7 sets of 3 on squat is a lot different than 7 sets of 3 on deadlift, right? Because deadlift, you just walk up to the bar, good to go. But on the other end of the spectrum, right, you have like this huge buildup. If you're just doing a set or two to failure, you have this huge buildup, and you kind of just have like peaks and valleys in arousal. Whereas if you're doing 7 sets of 3, you have to have like kind of a calm focus to you. Can't get too high. You definitely can't get too low. Because as soon as you get too low, it's going to feel a lot heavier than a 10 rep max or whatever you're using. So yeah, that's kind of the general overview. Is there's going to be different considerations. You theoretically in a strength phase, we might want to do 12 sets of one, 15 sets of one, just from, you know, again, from a theoretical basis. But then you start to add in these considerations. Okay, they have to unrack the bar, walk it out 15 times. So yeah, that's kind of where my head goes.
Yeah, I think that's the just from a conceptual basis, the only thing we've kind of shifted our mind on over time, kind of similarly related to that, is instead of matching, you know, in a very technical sense, like the number of reps with the given load, probably more so going for like matching the stress, which is not something we can quantify. It's just like this kind of conceptual, you know, if I do, you know, four sets of five with a given weight, all right, not a bad example. If I do three sets of five with a given weight and I do five sets of three with the same weight on paper, that's, you know, the same amount of repetitions, should be the same training effect. But then when you add in those two additional unracks, that has like this non-quantifiable amount of increase in stress, whether that's related to arousal, whether that's related to some of the force stuff we talked about. The reality is it's something you do have to account for. And so I think that's where we've kind of shifted our mindset of, instead of just simply flipping the sets and the reps, it is going to kind of be this individual dependent thing that isn't purely analytically math based. You know, you might go from, you know, three sets of six to four sets of three. And that just might be what happens. And that's not going to perfectly match up in terms of no total number of repetitions, but that may be what's right for an individual. So I think that's just something that kind of goes along with that. And it's related to psychological arousal and unracks and stuff.
What have you guys seen anecdotally from the plethora of clients that you've worked with over time, as far as people that psychologically prefer, you know, fewer sets with more arousal versus more sets with less arousal?
I think it depends how bought in they are to kind of the conceptual idea of how we might design a strength phase. So people that are bought in and like, they might reach out to us because they're like, hey, this makes a lot of sense. I think this might help me with X lift. Like, I want to work together. Let's see how this works. In that case, they're going to be all for it. Right. Other cases, like, what do you mean you want me to take my feet up bench only to an RP 5 to 6? Like, what are you talking about? Like, what are we even training? So it's going to be very like a matter of like what they've been exposed to in terms of like our stuff or other people's stuff. If they come from like a super high intensity training background, that's going to be a very, very hard transition. Also, it's going to be how receptive they are to what the coach says, right? Like, hey, this is what I think is best on paper. If they're not going to be receptive to what you think is best on paper, you're going to have to walk backwards from there. So again, I feel like our answers across the board today have been, hey, it's going to be individual, but I really think that's the case here. You know, I've definitely had some people where I make compromises in terms of the design to the strength phase. Of course, I try to be as strategic as possible, just because of a buy-in and enjoyment factor, which, yes, might seem like, oh, you're making a sacrifice, but it's also like still more optimal in the sense that if they're enjoying training, that's going to lead to better outcomes in and of itself, right? So that's kind of how I think about it.
Not much, Dad. Totally agree. Okay.
Does that ratio change at all, do you think, when someone's in a deficit? Like, might you lean one way more than the other?
That's a great question.
I mean, just off the cuff, it's like, I just always come back to like the training you did to get the muscle is probably similar to the training you want to do to keep the muscle. But mm-hmm. That's kind of a cop-out answer, though, I feel. You know, I can understand it, like some lower fatiguing protocols to make sure you can continue to perform. Anecdotally, I've heard people, you know, I haven't been in a severe deficit myself, lifetime skinny kid, so I try not to do that too much. Anecdotally, I've heard people that keeping performance is generally related to, you know, how much muscle they keep. Some of that seems obvious, but like, it's like top end strength, I guess, like on the exercises that you care about. So like your 6RM on hack squat, let's say. And so maybe doing some of these strategies that allow you to hold on to a little bit more strength potentially could be a little bit more useful in scenarios where it's a little bit difficult to build it. But that again, that's just totally anecdotal, and I can't have much personal experience there.
Yeah, I don't have much experience with the strength phase specifically because most of the time I try to make it so that the athlete is at maintenance or their surplus or deficit is minor leading into a test, just for reasons of like, hey, I don't want your belt, the way your belt fits, to be kind of shifting over this 6 week strength block. I also don't want, I don't want you to necessarily be losing weight from a predictability perspective, in terms of strength. So like the way that we like to think about it is like, the hypertrophy phases are going to be your like body composition manipulation phases. And then the strength phase is like, okay, let's maintain or kind of be in a more or less narrow window of your calorie maintenance. And kind of, you know, try to hold steady up until a strength test. So that's kind of the reason why.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I like that answer. It's good. Straker, I'm done. I don't have any more questions for him.
All right. I'm very excited to talk about this. So a little bit of background history. Like I worked as a software engineer for like multiple years. So as much as I've, you know, shifted away from that from a career standpoint, you really can't get rid of these nerd tendencies, right? You don't go into that without that kind of being in place. So I'm going to talk about the kind of the hybrid product you guys have, the DDSIP, which is a really sweet acronym, by the way. I believe data-driven strength individual programming.
Exactly. Individualized programming.
Individualized programming. So just tell us a little bit more about it. And then I want to unravel just some of the cool things about the cycle, some of the auto-regulation, and just take me through your thoughts around how you guys built it and stuff. And please feel free to share as much, or obviously don't disclose any IP or anything like that, please.
Awesome, man. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. Obviously I don't want to make this a sales pitch, so bring it back towards practical stuff as needed. But the way that I would kind of describe the service is that it's somewhere between automated programming and group coaching. So we're like, okay, how can we like make it as close to coaching as possible, but also make it affordable? So we're like, okay, what do we think actually needs to be individualized on, you know, on a lifter to lifter basis? So we kind of said, okay, let's pick up the big, you know, three or four training variables that we think are super important to dial in. And that seemed to act like getting those in the right range for the individual seemed to really move the needle in terms of getting that individual to progress. So basically what we did is we have these training variables that we think are more or less the big hitters in terms of individualization. And we have a system for helping each lifter dial that in over time. So we'll get a starting point based on like some initial questionnaires. And then after each training cycle, there are further questionnaires. So we have like data analysis tools to, you know, give you some guidance as to, hey, based on your strength level, based on your rate of gain, this went well for your squat or this didn't go well for your squat, right? Cause we want to have a system so that when things don't go well, we have a way to adjust accordingly. Same idea with fatigue. Hey, based on kind of your questionnaire responses throughout the, or based on like your reports throughout the training cycle, you are really fatigued for your squat. This is good information going into your next training cycle. So it's kind of this cyclical process of dialing in these big hitter training variables. And then the group aspect is like, hey, I want to make a more nitty gritty change that isn't built into to kind of the algorithm or the system itself, or this is kind of an edge case scenario. That's where kind of the manual side of it comes in, right? Myself and Zach are very active in our private Facebook group, helping out like case specific stuff. We have, kind of our back end dude. His name is Drake Easerhot. He did some athlete monitoring stuff with, during his master's degree. So he's super well versed in, like, you know, kind of the back end stuff that we use for this. So, you know, it's kind of that combination of, yes, it's kind of automated, but it also has that personal touch and that allows us to deliver it to more people and at a more affordable price.
Awesome. Follow-up question there. So with this individualized programming specifically, is this one purely powerlifting?
So when you sign up, there's an option to select powerlifting, strength and size, or muscle growth. So powerlifting, which like you're going to get more jacked in the prime movers for the big three because we think that's important. But then the strength and size is like, hey, oh, you also care about physique. Okay, here's like the cherry on top type stuff. We're going to make sure you cap those delts a little bit. And then muscle growth would be, hey, I don't care about strength at all.
Full disclosure, I cheated on my answer about the kind of low fatigue strategies for physique athletes. That's literally just the exact kind of big change we made to the hypertrophy programs that we're really excited about, kind of offering a little bit more of a comprehensive way to design those training cycles rather than just kind of your standard, programming, I guess, a little bit more interesting. We mostly think that's just a psychological thing to offer some benefits and have some fun. But like I said, speculative case for physiological resensitization.
And then question, and this is purely like a personal one. Like, let's say, so for instance, I plan on moving into the strength cycle here in the coming months, but I'm not really overly interested in a bench press. I'm more interested in an overhead press. Is that like a sort of customization that could go into the system, or would that be more of like the group coaching aspect, post that in the Facebook group type of deal?
It would be the latter. So, man, I'm surprised the number of people that like to swap in just overhead press. Right now, it would just be based on like squat bench deadlift. We actually do have a handful of people that are just like you. What they would do is they would just change the exercises, kind of make a one-to-one swap. Okay, you're doing regular bench press, change that to regular OHP. We have you doing feet up, dumbbell bench. Okay, change that to seated dumbbell overhead press. Have you doing pause, three count pause bench press, whatever. Change that to pin overhead press. So you can do that and then just kind of use the bench press analysis and say, okay, this is actually for overhead press for me. So that is kind of a limitation, but there is kind of that workaround that, again, is a shortcoming of the algorithm, but we kind of, help people on a case specific basis.
Yeah. And that's one thing we worked really hard to do. So the full name of the thing is individualized programming plus self-coaching toolkit. So we know like there's a ton of people like Josh and I were trying to design this product for ourselves. Right. So we're tinkerers just like you guys, like we like messing with the details. So you also wanted to provide every single tool necessary for you to make the adjustments and play around with some stuff. So, we monthly webinars and stuff to have new ideas, and education as more research comes out and stuff. But that was the whole purpose of like people like you that have that change they want to make. We want to make sure you're not locked into just doing stuff that, maybe isn't going to fully meet your goals. So we try to accommodate as much of those changes as we could to make sure that everybody's accounted for.
Cool. Yeah. It definitely sounds like something very, very, interesting. It's like a blend of my interests, right? All in one. And I hate to draw the parallel, but it does remind me of like the old days of the Juggernaut, AI. I had ran that a number of years back and it buried me in volume. And I'm a person who likes volume and that was rough for me. But it's just a very, very cool thing of, putting together strength, putting together the science aspect of it and some of the algorithm AI type stuff. Because for a large majority of people, right? There's obviously going to be the fringes and stuff like sound principles. They're sound principles for a reason because they apply to a large, distribution of people. And I think that's something really, really cool. So the last kind of question I have there for each of you guys is what would you say your favorite part of that kind of service slash product that is that you guys have built together?
That's a great question.
I'm going to go for the one thing I want to clarify from the last question. Every single one of the training options in DDSIP has been coach verified. So just to be clear, that's something we worked really hard on too. So you're not going to get some crazy thing that shouldn't be done potentially. But as far as my favorite aspect of the product, I think it's probably, and I just want to give a massive shout out to Drake. Josh mentioned him earlier. He works really, really hard on a lot of the back end stuff and has created some novel athlete individualization tools and data analysis stuff that I think is really, really cool. And so like the performance evaluation that we have is, it integrates some research that we have on base rates of gain for different strength levels, as well as some formulas in order to make it not just like a binary, did you increase strength from pre to post? It's a little bit more complicated than that. And I think it's a really good way to offer a comprehensive way of evaluating progress. That's a little bit, it's not ordinary. I think he worked really hard on it. And I want to give him a ton of credit for digging that out. And I think it's something that offers a ton of value to the person that's using it.
This is probably a cop-out answer too, but like I'd say my favorite thing in terms of like just my day-to-day related to this product is always being surprised with how freaking smart our lifters are. Like when we were putting this guy, like, will people understand this? Like, will they know what we mean? Like, are people gonna be able to catch on? And we're like, people are just taking it and really making the most of them. Like, we gotta give these people more credit. Like, our audience is just freaking smart. and smart and also just like resourceful. So I thought that, I think that's the coolest thing on a lifter to lifter basis, right? Like some people just get it, kind of stick with the default or like our go-to exercises that we kind of have built in there. But then we have, you know, resources. Hey, this is the case where you might want to change this exercise to this. People asking super good questions using those resources, but also some people accepting like, hey, I'm not really interested in investing that time. I'm just going to kind of go with the starting point. So seeing people understand that and like also invest the effort to kind of think through that has been super, super cool. Like we have people incorporating velocity. So like Zach's next webinar, that's coming out later this week, all about velocity-based training, how to incorporate it within the system. Is everybody going to use that? No, but I know there's going to be at least a handful of people that are going to incorporate it and really benefit from it. And it requires a good amount of thinking to be able to incorporate those concepts. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that is kind of a testament to you guys and the type of audience you attract, right? When people come across your stuff and like, okay, data-driven strength, you guys are obviously very well-spoken. Everything is very, very, you know, applied to research and stuff. People are not going to be, you're not going to get like your super bros who just want to like sling weights and not think about it type of stuff. So I think that is something that I think would make a lot of sense based on just how you guys carry yourself and the type of things you talk about for sure. That's super cool.
Appreciate it, man. Appreciate it.
I'm constantly surprised by how intelligent the evidence-based community is for the most part.
Yeah,
for sure.
No doubt.
Yeah. I mean, that's all I had on that. It's definitely something I plan on looking more into. I have to really, I have to give myself a little bit. I have some like a gut protocol I'm running that I need to reduce training intensities and stuff for the stress reason. So probably a couple months until I'm around, but it is something very, very cool that I definitely plan on looking into.
Awesome. Awesome, dude. Thank you so much for letting us talk about it too.
Of course.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on, guys. It was really cool to pick your brains and be able to connect in this manner.
Likewise, fellas. Dude, appreciate the opportunity to be on. We have kind of had to put off like guest appearances on podcasts with our research schedules. You guys were in the books, for a while. So I'm glad this all worked out. It was a really good time.
Yeah. Seriously, guys, I had a great time. Thank you so much.
Of course. Before we hop off, guys, plug where everyone can find you guys and get more information about the DDSIP, of course.
data-drivenstrength.com. That can take you to articles, services, all that good stuff. And then Instagram, josh.datadrivenstrength and zach.datadrivenstrength. Find all the stuff from there.
Perfect. And I'm going to link all of that up in our show notes so they can find you. So again, Zach and Josh, thanks for coming on. And everyone, we will talk to you next week. Thank you so much for listening to Eat, Train, Prosper. If you found this episode valuable, please subscribe or share us with your friends. You can find more from Aaron at StrakerNutritionCo.com and more from Brian at EvolvedTrainingSystems.com. Talk to you guys next time.